Thank you for joining us for Sermons on Demand from Friendship Grace Brethren Church. We provide these videos as a way to share the pulpit messages and teachings offered at Friendship Grace Brethren Church. If you find these videos a helpful resource, please drop us a note at info@friendshipgracebrethren.com. Now open your Bibles and get ready to dig into the Word of God. Okay. Anybody have any questions this evening before we get started? I've already taken one, and I'm going to take credit for one tonight already.
I have one.
Okay, go ahead.
In John chapter 12, verse 31, it says, "Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. The ruler of this world is Satan." So I couldn't decide how that would be interpreted. Now will Satan be cast out? So is this a reference to when Satan was cast out earlier, or is this the actual time when Satan was cast out of heaven?
Well, he's not cast out of heaven. We know that because several places in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul and others tell us that he's standing in heaven and accusing us. So we know that can't be the right answer.
So I couldn't figure it out.
Yeah, so look at the context there. You're talking about John 12:31, right?
Yes.
Look at the context there. Jesus is giving some teaching on what's going to come. The disciples don't yet understand what's going to happen. It's not possible, I don't think, for them to understand it yet. And he begins in verse 27, "Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I came to this hour." And there is this continuing theme in what he's saying to them about the end is coming. He then says, "This voice has come for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out." And your question of when is now is difficult in one respect, because we're talking about a timeless God. And so now is now and later. But that's not a satisfactory answer. But just know that that anytime God says that God makes a time reference of himself, it's impossible for us to narrow it down without some external function, because he's timeless. So a time reference is really meaningless, because he's always present, never past, never future. So it can only be now, but it's the entirety of his length, but there is no length because he's timeless. So it gets very convoluted when you think about that. And it's not a satisfactory answer. It doesn't help you understand it at all. But you need to know that when God makes a reference to himself about time, it doesn't have a real meaning to him. That's not the right way to say it. It doesn't constrict him any. So let's consider what now could mean here. We've already proven that now doesn't mean that that's when Satan was cast out, because we know he's still, the Apostle Paul tells us that Satan is still in heaven accusing us. So we know that can't be an answer. So you could argue that now is a reference to the time when he is ultimately lifted up. Let me go back to the verse here. "I have come to this hour, Father, glorify your name." And then this voice has come from your sake and not mine. Now is the judgment of the world. When is Jesus lifted up? When is Jesus, in the world's view, placed in a position of glorification?
See, and I interpreted that different. I thought about him being lifted up on the cross.
Well, that's
lifted up late.
Right. That's one view of lifted up, but it doesn't always mean that. So when could you? I'm sorry, Ann. Go ahead.
When he comes back to take the throne.
Right. Right. Because notice what the context is. It's glorifying God. Surely God is glorified in Jesus on the cross, but that seems counterintuitive, right? Because it's an ugly, ugly hour. Stop it. So, when you look at, now is the judgment of this world, now will the ruler of this world be cast out, and when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. When does that occur? That's yet future, like Ann said, when he takes the throne. So this could be a messianic kingdom reference, or
when Satan is bound during the millennium.
Exactly. Or it could be an eternal heaven and earth when Satan is bound permanently. And now, I don't know all the grammatical words to use, but now has to be modified by something. And it seems like the context requires now to be modified by that yet future event when he's lifted up and glorified and all people are drawn to him. That didn't occur on the cross.
Right.
We're hard-pressed to say Jesus was glorified on the cross. He was defiled on the cross.
He put it there.
I'm sorry?
Isn't it interesting that he put it there? Because it's talking about, in the paragraph before that, he's talking about Greek-seeking Jesus, and in the paragraph after that,
right,
or is the unbelief of people, but the following, for it could be Jesus came to save the world.
Right.
This is stuck in the middle of all of these belief things.
Right. So, Jesus is building his case for that period of time in the yet future, I think, is the only proper way to interpret this. Let me look to see what Holman says on it, if anything. Yeah, Holman says, once again, reference to Jesus being lifted up centers not on exaltation, but death. Holman, and I'd have to look to see who wrote this particular book, but it is Ken Gangle, so he's a good guy.
It says in verse 32, and when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. He said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die.
Right.
So that's why I'm going. It was talking about Jesus' death and judgment, not future time.
Well, correct. But just like when Jesus was on the cross and he said, "It is finished," it wasn't finished then. That now wasn't then, because it's still not finished, because we haven't received our glorified bodies, and we're not immortal present with him. And so that's why I led with now being a kind of a difficult construct for a timeless being. That's kind of like saying what color looks best on a spirit. Well,
yeah.
Right. See, it doesn't work. So,
yeah.
I think one of the most fascinating studies ever is God and time. And what's modified in God and time by Jesus in a physical mortal body. Now glorified body. Time now means something different to him. Although he's immortal, he's glorified, he's eternal, but he also has a physical body and he didn't before. And so time gets modified by that. And I think that's a fascinating study that I don't think I have the capacity to really enter into. We used to have a kid in the youth group that loved to talk about that. And we would have debates about that often. His name was Austin. And I sent him to read some books by William Lane Craig, who has done the most that I know of anybody on talking about God and time. But I don't pretend to understand how you can be timeless inside time. But that's where Jesus is. Part of kenosis, surely, but I don't understand how it works. And I don't understand what it means for the future. So, there you go.
I have another question.
Okay.
I'm full of them. John 11, verse 5, it says, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus." And this is the beginning of when, and then he stayed 2 days longer, and then he raised Lazarus from the dead. I get all that. And I know why he stayed 2 days later, so that he could show his power for the resurrection and blah, blah, blah. But I find it so peculiar that whole thing is begun with, "Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus." Why was that important to say before he goes on to tell about the raising of Lazarus? I just found that a peculiar thing to say at the beginning of that pericope.
Well, what is that word there, loved? It's agape.
Yeah.
So he had an affection for, a brotherly love type concern for.
He had the desire to do what is best for them, I guess.
Yeah.
That's the kind of love agape is.
Yeah, that works. We're going to actually talk about the raising of Lazarus in a little bit.
It's not that I don't think I just found that an odd statement to come at the beginning of that whole section.
Wouldn't it be telling the readers that, you know, he waits 2 days to go to Lazarus, and Lazarus is dead, and John is saying that Jesus loved them, so he had a point in his delay. He didn't delay because he didn't love them. He delayed for some other reason.
Oh, he definitely delayed for another reason, and we're going to talk about that. There, I discovered something new today that I didn't know. I do that every day, but this was kind of cool. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I think you're right, Anne. John is introducing Lazarus to his readers for the first time. And he didn't have all of the family history or the friend history that some of the other Gospels told about Lazarus and Jesus. What's the name of the play group that we like? What is it, Linda? You're muted. Sight and Sound. I had to read your lips. They're sorry about that. My mind went crazy. Their portrayal of Jesus and Lazarus was really cool. And they displayed Jesus as having a really close friendship with the family. And they didn't say it, but they kind of hinted that it had been ongoing since they were all much younger. And John is introducing that to the readers who, by and large, probably didn't know much of that. Remember, John's writing 60 years after the events. And so the people... Yeah, the events happened in 30 A.D. John's writing close to 90 A.D.,
he wrote the Gospel of John and Revelation very close to each other?
He wrote all his books close together.
I thought he'd written the Gospel much earlier
than that. No. Yeah. So he's writing to people that didn't have that knowledge. And so he's setting the stage, basically.
Makes sense now.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm done.
Any other questions? Okay. Then let's go to the first question I got tonight. Read John 7, 25 through 31. What is the meaning of the signs in this passage? 7, 25 through 31. Jesus answered them, I did one work and you all marvel at it. Moses gave you circumcision, not that it's from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision, so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body well? Do not judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. Some of the people of Jerusalem, therefore, said, "It's not that this man whom you is not this the man whom you seek to kill, and here he is speaking openly, and they say nothing to him. Can it be that the authorities really know that this is the Christ? But we know that where this man comes from. But we know where this man comes from, and when the Christ appears, no one will know where he comes from." Come on, you can change now. Yet many of the people believed in him, that's Jesus. They said, when the Christ appears, will he not do more signs than this man has done? So the question is, what's the meaning of signs in this passage?
I think that all the signs of the Gospel of John were signs to prove or authenticate that Jesus was who he said he was.
Which is who?
Referred to the Messiah.
Okay. So here's what we need to understand. In the Old Testament and in Jewish tradition, remember, both of those had equal weight to the Jew at the time of Jesus. The Old Testament and the rabbis' writing and tradition on the Old Testament carried equal weight, much like the Bible and the Pope's edicts and so forth carry equal weight. So in the Old Testament and in Jewish tradition, there were four specific miracles that the Messiah would use to identify himself. Those miracles are, beginning with, he had to heal someone born blind. And so we see that in our reading this week, is Jesus healed a man born blind. The Messiah would heal or cleanse a leper. The Messiah would raise someone from the dead after more than 3 days. Now, this is what I didn't know before. Why after more than 3 days?
Because then they were stinking and really too decayed.
No, because Jewish tradition held...
Oh, the soul hadn't left.
Say that again, Sybil?
The soul hadn't left. They want to make sure the soul left.
Correct. Jewish tradition was that the soul doesn't leave for the first 3 days. So after...
Jesus had the first 3 days.
So after 3 days... During those 3 days, they could be rejuvenated, and it wouldn't be a messianic miracle. But if they'd been dead more than 3 days, the nephesh, or soul, would have left the body, according to their understanding, and so only the Messiah, or God himself, in Jesus' case the same, could raise them from the dead. So here's Jesus. This gives new light to why Jesus cried at Lazarus' tomb. Here's Jesus. he's still in Galilee, and he gets word, hey, your buddy is really sick. Let's beat feet down to Bethany, just outside of Jerusalem, so you can heal him. Or at the very least, let's get there before the 3 days are up. And he says, no, let's hang around for a couple of days. That never made sense to me, because he's doing the miracle one way or another. It never made sense to me that it wasn't about the miracle. It was about the timing of the miracle. So Jesus then goes to Bethany, you know, at least a day walk, the 2 extra days, 3 days have passed now, so he's dead. You know, like Dell talked about on Sunday morning, well, how dead am I? Well, you're smoking in a hole dead. And so Lazarus was dead. And then, in doing that, in raising him from the dead, it was another one of these 4 miracles that are messianic. So Jesus heals someone born blind. Jesus cleanses a leper. He raises someone from the dead after more than 3 days. And he casts out demons. He has checked every box of what the Jewish tradition and the Old Testament specified would be messianic sign miracles.
But doesn't he tell that to the disciples of John?
Yeah.
They ask, are you the Messiah? And then it's all he says. And then they went away, and it says, and then he knew he was the Messiah.
Well, I think he always knew that he was the Messiah, but then they certainly knew. But right, you're absolutely right. He didn't disclose all of that at first. But here by John 11, we're getting real close to the end of his ministry. John is really backloaded in ministry time. He doesn't cover much of the early part of his ministry, but the majority of the book of John is all about the last few weeks of his ministry. And so, go ahead.
Am I right in thinking that maybe Jesus wept because he knew he had to bring Lazarus away from the Abraham's bosom and back into a body on earth?
No, I think that Jesus wept because he knew the torment he put Martha and Mary through. He knew what the grief was, and they went through that torment so that he could prove that he's the Messiah. And that was painful to him.
You don't think it was painful for Lazarus to have to come back?
Probably. Probably, but he would also get to spend more time, and then he would go to heaven, because presumably he died after Jesus and went during the church, so absent from the body. What Jesus did was enable him to go straight to heaven.
True.
But it always bothered me that Jesus would stand at the graveside and weep, knowing he was about to raise him from the dead. But he purposefully delayed so he could demonstrate to the world and to the Jewish leadership. I think there's a real reason why he did that when he did it. I think Jesus had a need to make sure that the Jewish leadership was going to execute him. Because, of course, he needed to die on the cross. Otherwise, salvation for anybody from Adam on down wouldn't be real without Jesus on the cross. And the Jews had to execute him. And so he was kind of almost like poking the bear to make sure that that happened. So close to the end of his ministry, he's demonstrating to the world that he is the Messiah. He's doing things. Go ahead.
He's right in the backyard of the people that are out to get to.
Right. Close to. Yeah, he was warned. Don't go back to Jerusalem because they're going to kill you. Well, yeah, I know. That's the point.
And that would be a particular miracle that would kind of be the icing on the cake.
Right. Right. I didn't go through and see the timing of all of these 4 things, but we have read recently of these four events in the book of John. So John is describing what leads up to him washing the feet in a couple of days, or in a few days, of the disciples getting arrested and going to the cross. John is preparing the readers for that, and has now documented, here are the miracles of the Messiah. And the whole thing with Lazarus is an emotional time for him. Sure, he was concerned about Lazarus, but I think he was more concerned. Lazarus wasn't hurting in Abraham's bosom. He was hanging out and having fun. As Brian often puts it, partying with Jesus. Wasn't with Jesus, but with Abraham, Moses, and all those guys. So here now he brings him back. So I get there is some emotion by that, but he knew Mary and Martha were going to be distraught at losing their brother. And he knew that the reason it was done was for him. And he doesn't like things like that, necessarily. So, signs, I think, in this passage is a direct reference to Jesus' miracles that authenticate him as the Messiah, as per the Jewish custom and tradition and teaching of the Old Testament. Questions, comments on that?
Very good.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to John 8, 48 and 49. John 8, 48 through 59. Why is this exchange so important? So here's what the exchange says. Then the Jews answered him, Are we not right in saying that you are a Samaritan and I have a demon? No, I wish I could read today. Are we not right in saying that you are a Samaritan and have a demon? Jesus answered, I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. Yet I do not seek my own glory. There is one who seeks it. He is the judge. Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death. Then the Jews said to him, now we know that you have a demon. Abraham died, and did the prophets, yet you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death. Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died, and the prophets died? Who do you make yourself out to be? Jesus answered, if I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say he is our God. But have you known him? I know him. If I were to say that I did not know him, I would be a liar, like you. But I do know him, and I keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad. So the Jews said to him, you're not yet 50 years old. Have you seen Abraham? Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. There's one of those timeless statements. So they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple. So why is this exchange important?
He flat out compared with God. That was a deity statement.
Okay.
And they called him a Samaritan.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
One insult.
Right. That was perhaps the worst thing you could call a Jewish rabbi, is a Samaritan. It's
God
worse.
Bless, he could be the Messiah if he was a Samaritan.
Correct. Yeah, he. It would be better for them to call him a Gentile than it would be a Samaritan, right? In their value system.
Yes. But I don't think Jesus would take it as an insult so much, because he loves everybody. But if he was truly a Samaritan, he couldn't be the Messiah.
Right, right. And it wasn't how Jesus took it. It's how they meant it that's important. They meant it as an insult. But I think there are two primary reasons this exchange is so important. The most obvious one we've talked about is Jesus claiming to be God and that he and God are one. That's very clear in the text, I think, right? He's making a claim of his own divinity, which a lot of people say Jesus never did, and that's just not true. I think a reason not often seen is that, and this carries on from where we were in the last question, I think Jesus was solidifying the Jews' antagonism toward him. Excuse me. Again, we're nearing the end. You know, what did he do? I think Sybil brought this up earlier, that that Jesus told something to the disciples of John, and it didn't go any further. But now things are progressing differently. Jesus is overtly pushing and antagonizing and solidifying that they're going to call him names, Samaritan, demon-possessed, so forth. And now he has given them, according to their law, a legal reason to execute him. Because in what they understood of the Old Testament text, it wasn't possible for Jesus to be God. Their text was very clear, Deuteronomy 6:4. Hear, O Israel, our God, he is one. They didn't understand one triunity. They didn't understand anything about the Trinity. And so according to their understanding, I'm using my words carefully, not saying according to the law, I'm saying to their understanding of the law, Jesus could not be God. So for them, Jesus was providing a perfect crime to charge him with.
And ultimately, that's the charge that they gave to Pilate for him to be killed.
Right.
Is that he was blasphemed.
Right. Right. And they had to do that. Because they had to, that was the only way they could stop what he was saying from being believed, is they had to execute him for blasphemy, because it was technically, according to their understanding of the law, their application of the law, a violation of the law. It wasn't a violation of the law, but they understood it to be, and so they had to execute. Jesus was making sure that the execution went through. Now, think about this from the creator-sustainer standpoint of who Jesus is. He's doing all the logistics of making them think what they needed to think so that he was executed. He was doing all of that work knowing that it was taking him to the cross. But you wouldn't want to play chess with Jesus, because he has the ability to see past all of that. We get stuck in the one or two, three moves that we're in. Jesus here clearly is demonstrating he's looking well past that. He could play Star Trek 3D, three-level chess. See the moves in four dimensions that we can't even comprehend. And that's what he was doing here. We would call it poking the bear. He would call it following the plan that the Father had set out. But I think it's important that we see in this passage that Jesus is moving the ball down the field. And he's resetting the chains every play, so he gets closer. Sorry for my football references. So he's getting closer and closer to that finish on the cross.
Well, he does it again in the same chapter.
Right.
Oh, no, in the next chapter. In verse 35 through 38, Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And he answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is I who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him.
Right, but remember early on in his ministry, what did he do? Don't tell anybody.
Yeah. But now he's accepting worship, which is you only worship God.
Right. So what he's doing is making sure that the that things continue, that, that they happen the way he needs them to happen. He had to be executed. He had to be sinless for the propitiation to be effective. And so he was making sure that Israel did that. I don't know why it had to be Israel. That's part of soteriology I don't get, but it apparently had to be Israel. And he was rejected, and ultimately all of Israel will come to him. I think by the end of the tribulation, every Jew that's still alive will be a follower of Jesus. And that will be something we've never seen before. And I think Satan knows that. He's read the back of the book too, and I think that's why the oppression of the Jews is ramped up again so high. Worldwide. It's painful. Okay, any other questions, comments on that one? Okay, let's do a couple of principles here. Read John 9, 1 through 7. What principle or principles do you see in this passage, John 9, 1 through 7? And as he passed by, he saw a man born... say it right now. He saw a man blind from birth. I was reading a commentary on this, and the commentator said, yeah, he saw a man born blind from birth. Yeah, born blind from birth. Isn't that a little redundant? He's born blind. It has to be from birth. It can't be from some other time. I just sat there and read this. How is it that this went through so many editors and typesetters and proofreaders and peer review, and nobody caught how redundant that statement was? Sorry. And he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world. Having said these things, he spit on the ground. He made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with mud and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Okay, so what principles can we derive from these seven verses?
What happens in our life is so that God gets glorified, because God is the owner.
Okay, good. Jewish tradition, and I would argue that probably most everybody's in the world's tradition, is that if things go bad for you, it must be because you sinned, or because you're a bad guy, right? I mean, that's just normal human thinking, reasoning. But it was what's that?
That's what all the guys were telling Job.
Yeah, exactly, right. And it was something that the disciples too understood or believed, right? Because look at verse, what is it, 2? And the disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Their belief was he was blind because somebody sinned. Mom and dad sinned, so he was born blind. That was a common belief. Now, you know how much this passage frustrates me. I feel so bad for this guy. Here he is, I forget how we determined it, but one of the times we were studying this guy, maybe from one of the other Gospels, he was probably close to 40 years old. So here's a guy, 40 years old, and he's been blind his entire life, so that Jesus could have the opportunity to come by and give him back his sight and do one of the messianic signs. That's frustrating to me. Just like Jesus was frustrated at the agony that Mary and Martha had to go through. This guy went through 40 years of difficulty. And, you know, in Jewish culture of the day, you're at the bottom of the barrel when you're blind and can't provide for yourself. You know, you got to rely on alms for the blind, or family to take care of you. But this guy went through it just so Jesus could demonstrate who he was. So the principle in that is, I think, that God uses us. I think you said it earlier, Mary, that God owns us and uses us for what he wants. I think that's a right principle. What's another principle? Just because it's commonly taught doesn't make it true. How many things do we just think we know because it's, well, I've always been taught that, or I've always heard that. And so we just always We automatically accept that, but it's not necessarily true. The disciples are perfect examples of that. Well, who sinned? Or the parents? That was just a common misconception. And I think this story gives us that picture that things that are common are not necessarily true.
And could you also say that not all misfortunes in life are the result of sin?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, that's what Jesus says in verse 3. Jesus answered, it was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. He was blind so that God could do something. We had a... Go ahead, Steve.
Something I think about quite often when we talk about, you know, like you're frustrated because this guy had to suffer all those years of being blind. But there's a scripture verse that's someplace in the Bible that says, you know, our time here on earth is like a vapor. It's like, compared to eternity, the amount of time and everything we're here is just, it's nothing.
Right, right.
And so, you know, if you look at it in that perspective, it's mm-hmm. not like...
We had a conversation this morning in my cohort. We were talking, they asked me how things had gone as we made the transition to the house here. And I said, well, I think the spirit is really good as we meet for services. But I think that we're doing the right thing because Satan seems to be really going after us and causing us technical issues on Sunday morning. And so I explained to him what happened with the sound bar and how all of a sudden it worked Saturday night, but all of a sudden Sunday morning it didn't. And sure enough, the power supply was toast Sunday morning, but it worked Saturday night. And I said, I view that as Satan trying to stop us from, stop me from being confident and comfortable in what we're doing. We continued in the discussion a little bit. Sometimes we add things, that's not the right word. Sometimes we view things in a light that makes us more satisfied and lets us off the hooks. And I told him, look, I confess to you, that might be what I'm doing here when I say Satan is attacking us. But I truly believe that when it works Saturday night and then Sunday morning with nothing being changed, that it's more than just the way things are. And so I told him, I readily admit it might be me trying to rationalize that, but I don't think so. And they both said, no, probably not. But the reality is we need to be careful about spiritualizing everything. And not everything that happens to a person is sin. But for the same token, not everything that happens for the purpose to the person is specifically for you to see God get glorified somehow. So don't spiritualize everything. Just be open to when you can see it. Ultimately, God's glorified by everything, but not specifically so that you can see it.
Thank you for watching or listening to this teaching on demand from Friendship Grace Brethren Church. Please consider sending us an email at info@friendshipgracebrethren.com to let us know how this teaching may have helped you. Please also consider joining us in person at Friendship Grace Brethren Church, located at 10251 Metro Parkway, Suite 116, Fort Myers, Florida, just south of the intersection of Metro and Colonial Boulevard. Sunday school begins at 9 and worship service at 10 a.m. We look forward to seeing you in person at Friendship Grace Brethren Church.